It's Friday morning. Everybody's kind of grumpy because we're at the field and we don't necessarily want to be there that early or whatever. I'm warming up and the guys take the field and it's like 5 or 7 minutes before we're ready. And of course, I'm really angry. I'm upset. I'm thinking, guys, what are you doing? I need some more practice tosses in the bullpen. So I turn around and hurl some tasty curse words at my teammates. And all of a sudden I see there's this little blonde lady who's on the mound. And I'm thinking, you know, who is this? I break focus. All of a sudden I hear over the PA, and ladies and gentlemen, the sex doctor, Dr. Ruth, here to throw the first pitch. And I break focus. I go, you got to be kidding me. And she's Jewish and she's here throwing out a first pitch. The rest of that, or the next part of that story, is we're playing the Bet Shemesh Blue Sox, which are like the Yankees of Israel. They got the pinstripes, they're blue, the whole deal. They had some heavy hitters like the Yankees. And we get into a near brawl. Guy steps up to the plate, hits a home run for our team, just like a bomb. But their catcher thought that he pimped it a little bit, you know, like he flew his bat in the air or whatnot. He comes around to home plate. They exchange words, the catcher and the pitcher, and they go kind of chest to chest. And a little bit of, like, some words are exchanged. A guy gets hit. The bench is clear. This is in the subsequent innings. And right as the bench is clear, we hear from the PA. The true story, literally, Dr. Ruth goes, "Now, boys, if you play nice, I promise you great sex for the rest of your lives."
And did they stop fighting?
No, we went back at it.
One of the things in the book that you talk about is the different players and how, you mentioned about the Dominicans and others that were playing, but also you had an Australian,
yep.
Kind of a little bit of a crazy guy.
A wild man catcher, Dane Wigg. One of the beautiful things about the league was we got to learn about different cultures through these players who became really close friends. You know, the beautiful thing about sports and teammates is a teammate is kind of like a brother and a friend, but also a businessman rolled into one. So you get to meet all these crazy people. Dane Wigg was our catcher from Australia, and he was one heck of a catcher. He was a great defensive catcher, but he was a wild man. He got into it with a cab driver on one of his first days in Israel, and the story goes that the cab driver pulled out a gun on Dane Wigg when he wouldn't pay the fare, and he was trying to be a wise guy. Whether or not that was a story or real life, we're not sure.
Anybody else that stands out in your mind?
Gosh, that's a great question. There, I feel blessed to be around a number of characters, guys on my team that ended up as characters in the book. A guy named Dan Rotham was the first of only two Israelis ever to play Division I baseball in the United States. You know, another question about the book is, what about the Israelis? What's the infrastructure? Could they play in this league? And this guy, Dan Rotham, a very, very bright guy, works on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and a darn good baseball player. So he's one guy that I really felt fortunate to be around. I think I may have mentioned a guy named Nate Fish earlier on. We were talking about the gas. His full name, Nathan Israel Bloomberg Fish. He looks like a combination between like Moses and Howard Stern or something like that. He's got this shoulder-length, black, curly hair. He, in college, he was Kevin Euclid's roommate at the University of Cincinnati. Both played together, both Jewish. Nate Fish now runs a baseball academy in New York, and he's going to be the coach of the Israeli National League team this summer. But Nate Fish's occupation, it used to be in Brooklyn, where he's from, when he was not a graffiti artist, a street artist, he was spinning records as a DJ. So Nate Fish, the DJ slash street artist, was one heck of a character. He's in the movie Holy Land Hardball. He was probably the iconic figure of the IBL.
One of the things that I know, having been a pitcher myself and you being a pitcher, is that we like consistency with our umpires when they call balls and strikes.
Yes.
And I'm trying to figure out, you know, knowing the limited background there, what the umpires might have been like.
I was thinking of putting a chapter in the book, which is not in there, something like umpires, you know, and like one sentence about how poor they were. Didn't make it in there. Players like to rag on the umpires, and I kind of feel like saying that they were terrible or not very good would be kind of like a cop-out. But the umpires were not as skilled as they should have been. Let's just put it that way. We had these awards at the end of the summer called the Schnitzel Awards, kind of like just like an impromptu, sarcastic award show. And the award for best umpire, which really means the worst umpire, was a German that everybody referred to as the Nazi. We'll put it that way.
The one thing I do know is that baseball is baseball is baseball, no matter
yes.
where you go. And was it like that over there?
Absolutely. That's a really neat thing. Doesn't matter where you are. For me, what's engaging about the story is it's in the Holy Land and everything that entails, being in the Middle East, But once you step on the field, baseball is baseball. The bases, to my knowledge, were 90 feet. At least I hope they were. The mound was 60 feet, 6 inches. And the game was a game. Granted, we're playing 7 innings instead of 9. Ty settled with the home run derby. But we were competing, fighting, cussing, crying, having strikeouts, ground balls, just like anywhere else on the planet. And the powerful thing about sports, I really believe this, is that it can unify people and disparate cultures from all over the world.
Any special promotions for games like they have here in the major leagues or the minor leagues?
Gosh, nothing's coming to mind right now. They had, you know, kosher hot dogs before games, stuff like that. I can't think of any special promotions, but I tell you, during the first game, you know, like at any baseball game, they say, your kid, so it's little Sammy's at the scorer's table, please report. Well, when they say, Yehuda, please report to the scorer's table, your son Sam Weinberg is here. That's a little of the color of the league.
I assume that in taking on this adventure, you wanted it to be more than just about baseball. What type of approach did you take in wanting it to make more sense to you than just the baseball sense?
Absolutely. My day job is a high school history teacher. I have a master's in political science, so that stuff has always been something that's terribly interesting to me. And what made this unique experience was not just the baseball, but the fact that it was in such a dynamic part of the world. So really for me, baseball, and in the story as well, baseball is a lens for a story about the politics and culture of the Middle East. We were talking earlier about how baseball can reveal aspects of our humanity, our culture, our similarities, and our differences. So even though I was going to play baseball, I was really going to learn more, not just about myself, but about this really interesting, dynamic part of the world.
You went to the West Bank, you went to Ramallah, and anybody that knows anything about that part of the world knows it's not safe for anybody, not only Americans, not only for Jews, but just about anybody.
Right.
Tell me why you decided to take that trip.
Well, I'd just been fascinated by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for a long, long time. I talked about it with 13, 14, 15-year-old freshman and sophomore kids in class, always interested in how to bring in some real-life context. And some people over there were saying, it's dangerous, you are going to die, do not go over there. They don't like people like you. And I was talking to other people, and they said, it's perfectly fine, it's peaceful, it's the home of Jesus' birth and the hills of Nazareth, stuff like that. And so I wasn't really sure. I was conflicted. About halfway through the summer, I still hadn't been out there. I got an email from a gal that I had also been to Israel with a few summers before, and she's a Jewish girl. She was living in Ramallah, and she said, hey, I'm living over here. I'm working for an NGO on water rights issues. Why don't you come out and stay with me? And so I thought about it. Now I didn't have any more excuses because I knew somebody. I had someone who could show me around. And so I kind of turned to Nate Fish and I said, Fish, I got a friend in Ramallah. You want to go? And he kind of looked at me and he said, maybe. And so we made it happen.
I think about going into that part of the world since I've been in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. And you just have to be aware of the things that are around. You almost stand out, and we're not used to it. I mean, both of us are white Americans, and so therefore we move freely. But I'm wondering, when you got into that environment, what was the first thing that struck you?
Well, the first thing that struck me was the wall of separation, this big, tall, ominous gray fortress-looking thing with the guard towers. As soon as you go through, literally, the world changes. It goes from one culture to another in many ways. So I'm on the bus, and as soon as we go through this checkpoint, I look over at Fish, and we won't even talk, but we exchange these little smiles, and Fish whispers, dude, we're in the West Bank or something like that. And so I see these little kids, and they're standing on the side of the road, and they're throwing rocks. And, of course, they're throwing these rocks at this light post. And I'm thinking, these rocks, they could be throwing baseballs. You know, they could be throwing baseballs instead of rocks. So that was that. We get to meet my friend Susan. We walk around. I described Fish earlier as having this long, curly, dark hair. I'm about 6'5" and a tall, goofy white guy, basically. Walking through the streets of Ramallah, we were turning heads. People were breaking their necks to turn around and look at us. But it wasn't menacing. It was more just like looks at quizzical expressions, like they were interested. Many people were very friendly. And in fact, the smile was the expression of the day. So at first, while we were nervous, we ended up feeling quite at home.
One of the things that I have found in my travels in Afghanistan and in Iraq particularly, and I think it applies to the West Bank, I think it applies to Israel, I think it applies to all troubled countries. The common denominator, Aaron, that I have found is all people want the same thing.
Yes.
They want a job. They want a home. and they want safety. And I think the politics is what really stirs it up. Did you find that in interacting with the people in the West Bank?
Absolutely, 100% agree. People want to live their lives. I think we're more similar than we are different. If people can make a living, provide for their family, that's what most of us want, absolutely. When the economic system breaks down, if you're in a broken economic system for one reason or another, then things get difficult. You know, if we don't have enough food or money to provide for our kids, then things get pretty difficult. And in fact, one example of that, I've been in Ramallah for about 10 minutes visiting my friend Susan, and she tells us a story. We are eating at this diner called Sinatra's in Ramallah, in this little Christian section. I'm thinking, I haven't had lox and cream cheese and bagels one time when I'm in Israel, but I go over to the other side and I'm eating lox and bagels in Ramallah. That doesn't make any sense. She tells us a story about 1 or 2 months before, she's taken two of her friends around. Just so happens that when they're in the car, they get kidnapped at gunpoint in a cab. Now, granted, she's showing around two of her friends, this time me and Fish, saying 2 months before, she was with two friends, and they get kidnapped at gunpoint. So they're taken to this house. The kidnappers are quite nice. They teach them Arabic, and they give them tea and stuff. But it turns out that the person who had kidnapped them, sticking a gun in their face, was a fighter who was injured, and he couldn't pay for his medical bills. This is a story that she was telling us. So as soon as the guns pulled on them, their friends try to jump out of the car, open up the door. They say, don't do it. Susan thinks, maybe I should jump out. Maybe I shouldn't. They get to this house. Eventually, the situation gets resolved. This is the story she told me. When they give the guy a job with the Palestinian Authority as a policeman. Figure that out. But, you know, if the economic system is broken, they got to do something about it.
There is a very poignant story in this book about you and Nate running into a couple of kids. Pick up the story.
So this is later in the day after I hear the story about the alleged kidnapping. We've gone all through Ramallah. We went to the home of Jesus' birth. We're walking through the hills. We come back and the sun is just about to set, and we're going out for the night. We're actually heading home. And I had a baseball in the bottom of my bag, and I see two kids just playing in the alley. And of course, these kids reminded me of not necessarily some of the kids I taught, but some of the kids back home, and more importantly, some of the kids on the Israeli side of the wall who are fans of the game. And I thought, you know what? If these two kids were on the other side, were here with us in Israel, they'd be baseball fans. So I thought about the ball in the bottom of my bag, and I picked it up, and I went over, and I knelt down on one knee, and I gave a kid a ball. He didn't know what it was, you know, and I kind of did the throwing motion, and I took it back from him, and I threw it to him, and then he kind of got the idea, and he threw it back to me. And now his other buddy is in on the action, you know. He wants to play catch. So his other little friend steps out into the street. I give him the ball, and they start playing catch in the middle of this small alley in Ramallah as the sun is setting. I look up, and I see four or five little kids peek their heads out from over the railing because they see these kids playing catch. And I think to myself, baseball can bridge gaps. You know, if these two young kids were playing in the Little League in Israel, they wouldn't know any differences. They wouldn't know that they were supposed to be enemies or they had this centuries-old conflict. They just know that their second baseman was from one part of town and their third baseman was for another. And I got goosebumps, a little verklempt, you know. I kind of missed it up a little bit and thought sports can bridge cultures and conflicts the world over. It was a really powerful example of that, I think.
What one thing did you leave the West Bank with? What image that you'll carry with you the rest of your life?
The image that I'll leave with is those two boys playing catch. I will never, ever forget that. There's a picture of it in the book as well. That moment is seared into my memory. But in terms of an impression that I left with, I think it's what you said to start all this off. People are people. We are more similar than we are different. And if we can focus on those similarities and give everybody an equal opportunity to provide for themselves, then things are probably going to be all right.
Aaron Pribble talking about the game he loves and what he learned in his 1 year in the Israel Baseball League. Finally, I've known Carmen Policy for a long time. We met when 31-year-old Ed DiBartolo Jr. bought the San Francisco 49ers, and he brought his friend and family lawyer Policy in to help guide him and run the team. The team's early years for DiBartolo and Policy were disastrous, but 3 years after Bill Walsh was hired as the 49ers coach, they won the first of 5 Super Bowls. It was the team's Camelot years. Policy is a refined, thoughtful, articulate person, reflective of his lawyer background, but a dichotomy to his upbringing in the blue-collar mill town of Youngstown, Ohio, where he was born and raised. I asked Policy to tell me about Youngstown.
Well, the Youngstown that you see today is not the Youngstown that I grew up in as a boy and later actually started practicing law. At one time, it was a very first and second generation ethnic oriented town that had been very successful in terms of producing wonderful jobs, blue collar jobs, but wonderful blue collar jobs that surrounded and included the steel mills. And when the steel mills started going south, so did Youngstown. And unfortunately, wonderful people, wonderful work ethic, wonderful place to raise kids, and a wonderful place to become part of the American melting pot started really rusting.
When did your friendship with Ed DiBartolo Jr. start?
We were kids in Youngstown, and I was in the prosecutor's office and just ready to leave and start my own law firm. He had just graduated from Notre Dame. So, I mean, we're talking, you know, I was probably 25 and he was probably 23. And we met at a charity event at a golf course and sort of ran into each other. And then I had the good fortune of filing a lien for another contractor against his father's shopping mall that was being built. And his father really got upset. I mean, he used all kind of different language to describe the type of person I was. And he asked Eddie if he'd ever met me. And Eddie said, I met him and he's a pretty good guy. He said, I heard he's a decent lawyer too. So he says, Eddie said, let me try working this out. So he called me up and I went there and put my case on in front of Ed Junior and one of their attorneys, their accountant, their head of construction, and two of their development people. And I have to hand it to Eddie. Now, you have to understand, he was only like 22, 23 years old at this time. He came they sent me to the coffee shop to wait while they talked. So he came down and he said, look, go back into the boardroom. I think I worked this out for you. He says, and by the way, what are you and your wife doing for dinner on Friday? And I said, well, whatever I'm doing, I will not be doing if I could be doing something with you. So he said, well, let's go to dinner on Friday. So I went back in the boardroom. Everybody had a solid look on their face, and they shoved two pieces of paper in front of me. One was a release of lien that I had to sign, and the other was a check in full for the amount that my client was owed. And I'll never forget that, you know, as long as I live. And that's the way the relationship started. And that's also a glimpse into the kind of guy Eddie DiBartolo Jr. was.
You both grew up on the opposite side of tracks, did you not?
I would say that that's an understatement. Eddie grew up in the section of the Mahoning Valley that we would call the upper end section. It would be the section that never flooded. I grew up in the section that was euphemistically called the Hollow. So you could imagine, it did flood.
Water runs downhill.
Water runs downhill. I lived about a block and a half from downtown Youngstown. But it was a fun neighborhood. And as I said, a lot of ethnic balance. And we had, it was mixed racially. And as I remember it, everybody really, really got along reasonably well. And you might get in a fight, but you'd never get killed. And you might, you know, do some things that maybe we wouldn't consider totally appropriate. But there was no rampant drug situation, and there were no gangs, and people got along. It's just it's sad that hasn't remained the status quo.
Everybody is pretty much a product of their background and where they came from. And when you think back about where you came from, what is it that you took away from that young experience that today even affects you in the way you do business?
Growing up in Youngstown, where I grew up, with the family background, education, church, I'd say that the best thing that happened to me was I never developed a sense of entitlement. Everything I did based upon what it was expected of me or what I wanted to do. And if I did something that I wanted to do that wasn't expected of me, I always understood that there might be consequences that I would have to acknowledge and in effect assume. I think that those ethnic neighborhoods were great because there was a certain simplicity, yet clarity to where you're going, why you're going there, and how you're supposed to get there. And I just really think that part of whatever success I've achieved in life is the result where I grew up and how I grew up there.
One of the things that I've always admired you for is that you've always been able to see the bigger picture. You've always been able to relate to both sides, which I think has given you the capability of being fair. Now, I say that because you've never been judgmental in my mind. I've never seen you in all the years I've known you ever be judgmental about a person or a particular situation. Having said that, you had some very interesting cases when you went from the prosecutor's side to the defending attorney's side, did you not?
I had quite a few interesting cases. As a matter of fact, one might call it a kind of a fun professional existence because it was so exciting, so diverse, and in many cases, kind of crazy. And, you know, when you're in Youngstown, Ohio, and you want to be a trial lawyer, you basically will take anything that comes through the door so long as they could pay. And, you know, there's the old adage, Eddie always used to say, Carmen would always presume that someone was innocent until they were proven broke. But I'm not sure that that was totally fair on his part, but you had to make a living. And so I wound up handling any number of cases that ranged anywhere from representing a fundamentalist preacher accused of alienating the affections of a church member to first-degree murder cases to organized crime cases to rodeo animal harassment cases. I represent clergy, teachers, highway patrolmen, detectives on the police department, judges. I even represented judges. And it just makes for one great, exciting professional experience.
You were well suited then for the National Football League, obviously, from that background.
Well, with that background, I'll tell you what, I was perfectly trained, absolutely perfectly trained.
What did you learn about human nature?
Well, I think you started off mentioning the fact that basically I'm not judgmental, and I try not to be because I think once you become judgmental, you compromise your ability to deal with the situation. You certainly compromise your ability to achieve a desired result or an acceptable result. So I find that if you judge someone, you've made a decision. And once you've made the decision, it's not going to take much time for that person or that group to figure out you've made a decision. So you've alienated any possibility of dealing with them, trying to convince them that you're right, or at least trying to convince them that some portion of what you're talking about is right, and that they should maybe come at least halfway. So that probably was not only something I learned as part of the legal training. I think I felt that way even as a boy. I kind of always felt to really get the whole picture, you have to put yourself in the other person's shoes.
But I think one of the other strong points for someone like yourself is the fact that you remove emotionalism from the discussion and the debate and the negotiation. Not something that's very easy for an awful lot of people, and especially when it comes to sports and you've got agents trying to pitch an athlete and everything else. How hard was that for you to be able to remove that from the discussion?
It wasn't hard at first, and sometimes it would become more difficult as you developed relationships. And in the course of those relationships developing, you've treated people fairly, sometimes much better than fairly. You've taken care of things for them. They may have gotten in trouble. You squared it for them, their families, or for the people around them. And when you go back to the table and that doesn't seem to count for anything, then that would be the type of thing that might cause me to have a little trouble being unemotional and not, in effect, allowing my personal feelings to enter into the process.
Carmen Policy has joined us on Sports Byline, well-respected across the world of sports and also the National Football League. And, Carmen, I mentioned I wanted to talk to you about the art of negotiation when it comes to sports and athletes. You took over as the president. You also was an attorney for the 49ers before you became the president of the ball club. What are the dynamics of professional sports, albeit either the NFL or any professional sport, that is different from the real world?
Well, first of all, professional sport is not the real world. It's the show business. And just imagine, just don't think of the dealings, the business dealings in any professional sport as being related to what you see on the field and the way you admire the athlete and the coach and the purity of the game, if you will. The business end of it is more like Hollywood. It's more like all that happens with the media. It's really beyond the scope of common business, just like their lives and their pay scales and so forth are beyond the scope of the common man. So you've got to take that into consideration as you're dealing in that world. I think that you also have to take into consideration that egos are super inflated. The closer you get to the flame, the more inflation you experience. And so you have to not only deal with the non-realistic world of show business, you've now got to deal with the inflated attitudes and the self-indulgences of the people you're dealing with that are dealing with the stars in show business. So you've got to make you've got to really get yourself into emotional shape the way the players get themselves into physical shape when you're ready to go out there and compete, shall we say, at the bargaining table.
How difficult is it because of all the influences where you got people whispering into the ear of the athlete, well, you ought to be getting this and you ought to be getting that. You've got agents who obviously have a conflict because they're interested in their percentage of whatever they're going to get out of the contract. And then I think the last element, Carmen, is that most people, yourself or even owners who work very hard to get the money that they got in order to buy the franchise, all of a sudden is saying, I'm going to pay somebody this to play a sport who is going to make much more in 1 year than maybe most people make in a lifetime. How hard is it to bring all that into some realm of negotiation where some realism has to come into play?
It's extremely difficult. And in some ways, the easiest organization to represent is the organization that is viewed by the public and by the players as penurious, as cheap. And if they're squeaky tight, you always could sit there and say, hey, you know what I'm dealing with. Look at this ownership. Look at this family. They won't pay each other, let alone pay the players. So, I mean, the reality comes through quickly. Now, when you're representing Eddie DeBartolo, who has a big heart, basically a very generous nature to begin with in terms of most everything and everybody he deals with, even outside of sport, there's the feeling that the door is open and so is the checkbook. And if I don't get what my agent suggests that I'm entitled to, then it must be something personal that Eddie and the organization has against me. And that used to become a very tricky proposition to deal with. And one of the tactics I always used, and a tactic I used to preach to some of the younger people that would come under my wing, in the course of negotiation, don't ever portray yourself as the winner. You never want to come out of the negotiation with, number one, especially the player, thinking you got the best of it. Number two, you want the agent to always look like he did a really good job for his player, if the agent is a decent and good guy and an honest person. And then you even want the public to feel that the player came out of this maybe a little better or maybe a lot better than he should have, because that allows everyone to be a winner, and you're ultimately hoping that you're within the framework of your financial structure, and at the same time you've got a player who's happy, you've got the public who thinks you've done more than good for him, and everybody works in the same with the same spirit of cooperation much better from that point forward.
You know as well as I do, there is a structure to negotiations and the monies that are paid athletes. When there is a draft, the guy who is the first round draft choice overall is going to make more money than the guy who was the second overall pick, and right down through the 32 notches. Even on football teams, skill players, quarterbacks make more than offensive linemen. Wide receivers will make more than maybe linebackers and that sort of thing. So having said that, I know that Bill Walsh lamented greatly about the fact that players would go directly to Eddie and talk to him about their contractual situation. How difficult was that for you to deal with that?
Well, that, number one, to answer your question very directly, it was very difficult to deal with because you're balancing two super forces. You have Eddie DeBartolo, who was, in my opinion, a highly respected and beloved owner. And when I say beloved, I'm talking about in terms of the players and the coaches, the assistant coaches, and the public. On the other hand, you had Bill Walsh, who was a genius and headed to the Hall of Fame and a power in his own right. And Bill was everything we know him to be on the field. Bill had some drawbacks in terms of his personality, and I think Bill really wanted to be the central figure of that team. He wanted everything relating to the team and football to center around him, even the affection of the players. And I think that he kind of was a little jealous of Eddie. I think he was a little jealous of Joe Montana, to be honest with you, because I think Bill wanted history to view the success of the 49ers as being a product of his coaching, his management, and his system of football.
Was that because he got the opportunity to become a head coach late in his life? He was 49 years old at that time. He had been passed over for the Cincinnati Bengals job, for the San Diego Chargers job.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Bill was so damaged emotionally and psychologically by so many things that had happened to him, by people he felt were either totally unfair or totally, intellectually and talent-wise beneath him, that it almost created this neurosis, and he was overcoming it in many, many cases, and he was gonna get even, and he was gonna have it his way, and it's all gonna be a makeup for what hadn't happened. And the truth of the matter is, and you know this story very well because I told you even the day that Bill Walsh was introduced as the head coach of the San Francisco 49ers, Ed DeBartolo Sr. tried talking Eddie out of hiring Bill Walsh. He had talked to Paul Brown, who was revered, especially in the northeastern section of the United States. He talked to Don Shula. He had talked to Joe Robbie. He talked to the Nordstrom family up in Seattle and so forth and so on. They're football people, not John Nordstrom, but they're football people. And they said, Bill Walsh is bright, but he's not head coach material. And so these things really resonated in a stinging fashion with Bill. And so kind of dealing with the two of them and putting this in place was problematic. Now, what made it all work, and this goes back to what John Madden says, you know, the best deodorant is winning. Well, with what took the anger and the animosity out of the mixture were those Super Bowl trophies. Had we not won, I don't think Ed and Bill could have stayed together very long at all.
Which is harder, to become a champion or to stay a champion? And I think when you think about the 49ers and the struggles they had when Eddie took over the ball club in 1977 to get to a championship, then in 1982 and winning that Super Bowl, and then trying to stay there and eventually winning five, which was it in that organization and for the people in the organization?
I think that you have to almost say to yourself, becoming a champion kind of finds its own way with a combination of skill, good management, good coaching, luck, and drafting. And all of a sudden, you wind up with this team where pieces have been added, and these young guys are showing up on the field on Sundays doing stuff no one ever expected them to do, and lo and behold, Dwight Clark makes a catch in the end zone at Candlestick Park. Dallas goes home, having been eliminated from the playoffs, and the San Francisco 49ers won a Super Bowl. It was euphoric, and it was wonderful. No one quite felt like they had to pull out all their fingernails and go through the kind of struggle and so forth that we had to endure in the future Super Bowls. And once we got there, you have to understand, it has a narcotic effect. And you've got to start not only trying to maintain a high, you just don't want to go through withdrawal. And we got to a point, actually, where we'd be in the locker room after a game, and it was more the feeling of resolvement that you didn't lose than the euphoria of winning after a victory. And it just became one of those situations where we just had the win or we were nothing.
Carmen Policy has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking about the National Football League. What do you think is the seminal moment in recent history of the National Football League? Was it the salary cap that came into place where the game actually changed in your mind, Carmen?
I think the salary cap and free agency did change the game. I think that there are probably some negatives to that, but I also think there were some positives to it. I think there was an excitement brought about with the free agency as we have it, with some moderation tied to it. I think the salary cap also made it more of a thinking person's game, both from the standpoint of management and from the standpoint of the fans. And, of course, from the standpoint of the players. I think that the changes that can occur and did occur all of a sudden made teams realize if you're smart and if you do it the right way and you combine free agency with good drafting, you can get to the Super Bowl quicker than you could have under the normal system that existed before. Dynasties were no longer entrenched to the point of not being able to be dethroned. And you look at Dallas. I think Dallas's major run in the 90s was tied so much to the fact that they got their team together in one piece so young that they were able to hold them together. Those contracts were in place during you know the early periods of the Aikmans and the Emmitt Smiths and the Michael Irvin's life's period in the NFL. So I just think that the cap combined with free agency was a seminal moment that changed the game.
I know that Eddie DeBartolo and the family bought the 49ers for less than $16 million.
I think it was $17 million.
Okay. And then you had the Rooney family. I know Dan told me one time that his dad got the team for thousands of dollars. I think he might have only maybe even won it in a poker game or something.
Well, you know, Mr. May I tell the story?
Please.
All right. Well, first of all, I had the privilege and pleasure of meeting Mr. Art Rooney Sr., the chief, and we used to see him at the league meetings. So I was involved in the league when he was still going to the league meetings. Now, I did a lot of trial work in Cleveland, and the word around Cleveland was that Mr. Rooney Sr. had won a few bucks at the racetrack, and he was at the theatrical. The theatrical was one of the great Damon Runyon spots in America, and it was a bar, it was a restaurant, it was a nightclub. It had been the favorite of politicians, businessmen, maybe a few gangsters. You know, I mean, everybody went there, and he was there looking for some buddies to come together and invest in this football team he's going to get over in Pittsburgh. So he needed a few guys to come up with $500 each. And no one would do it except for one guy who said, I'll lend it to you, but you got to pay it back, you know. And so I think he put together like $2,500 or maybe it was $3,500. And he went ahead and wound up with that football team. And, boy, I'll tell you, it's one of the great stories of the NFL.
Well, I love the story that I've shared before, and that is we know Dan Snyder paid $850 million, a high range like that. But Bob McNair was down at the Super Bowl in Miami before he got the franchise because it was reported that they were going to go into Los Angeles, that they wanted to put a team in Los Angeles. And the Houston people wanted to have another team down in Houston. And he was being shown around the media room down there. And I finally had a chance to chat with him. And we got off into a corner, and I said, you know, Bob, you've got to explain something to me. I said, you know, it was $750 million for the Cleveland expansion franchise, and I think it was probably another, you know, $150 million to put the team on the field. I said, where does that make any sense, financial sense? And he looked at me and he says, Ronnie, $1 billion ain't going to change my lifestyle one bit. And it just, I mean, that blows my mind. Now, I say that as a preface because I have a friend of mine in the NFL league office who said to me that the commissioner every day gets a call from an owner saying, we've got to have more money. We've got to have more money. I mean, that push for more money, how much more money can they get out of the National Football League?
Well, your friend in the National Football League is right. The commissioner probably gets more than one call. Okay. And it's part of it is because I think you have to also understand that other than maybe the top seven or eight teams, the other teams are not making the kind of money that the investment they have in those teams would really justify. You could almost argue that take the money, instead of investing it in an NFL team, put it into a very safe, well-run fund, and you'll come out very much ahead without any headaches, heartaches, or anybody second-guessing you. Now, that having been said, of course, I think that we're dealing with a sport that is America's passion, and it keeps growing. Just when everybody says, oh, it can't possibly grow anymore, well, it's growing more and more, and everything is blossoming in an exponential way. It's incredible when you see it happening, but it's happening.
New media has really helped it a great deal.
New media has changed the whole dynamic of what's going on, and it's going to continue to do so. I don't mean to take you off any question that you might have, but I think one of the great challenges the NFL is facing today is how do they give the fan the kind of experience that makes it worth their while to get in a car or take rapid transit or mass transit and go to a stadium on game day and be there and experience the game at the stadium, as opposed to not having to leave, you know, your family room and stay right home and with friends and family and entertain yourself. Doesn't cost you anything except for whatever beer you're drinking, or as I like to say, fine Napa Valley Cabernet, and see this broadcast on this wonderful set with these various cameras giving you different perspective. I mean, that's the NFL's biggest competition on game day is its product being televised into the home. And that's why I think so many of these stadiums are trying to come up with the state-of-the-art facilities that give you this so-called unique experience that combines being there in the stadium with the multimedia experience.
Yeah, I want to talk about stadiums in just a second, but is the only thing that could screw up this wonderful financial golden goose greed either on the player's part or on the owner's part?
I think you almost have to view the NFL as Rome. I don't know that there was anything more majestic than that empire when you look from the beginning until its true decay.
It collapsed from within.
It collapsed from within. And somehow Rome was able to withstand even the most corrupt and almost sick leadership in the form of some of its rulers. It was able to overcome it. But you can't keep overcoming bad moves, bad people, bad mistakes. And you can't keep overcoming the greed that sometimes takes hold from within. And I also think that this could apply to a lesser degree to the players and to the leadership that stands in front of the players in terms of not only money, but conduct and the way they're perceived by the public. So what we have to do is see the players in the league as one empire and try to prevent the decay from within.
The argument seems to be, Carmen, that the owners are the ones that are taking the risk. They're the ones that put up their money. They're the ones that own the business. But the other side of that argument is that the business is actually the players. Without the players, you don't have a business for the owners. And it's a strong argument. What is the balance between the two?
Well, if you had this wonderful surgeon who is really, let's say, the best, recognized as the best surgeon in the country, who doesn't have any money and hasn't really, you know, been involved in construction and has no idea as to how to build a hospital, and he had no hospital to work, I don't know how he would really be able to promote who and what he is and what he can do. So if you give him a hospital, though, he's a star. And I think you have to view ownership in the league as providing the venue, the hospital, within which these professionals can work. And it's expensive, and it's hard to do, to keep it going and keep it state-of-the-art and up-to-date and so forth. And, I mean, I could use any number of examples. I don't have to use a surgeon in a hospital. I could talk about, how many movie stars are able to go out and form major film companies with major production staff and the kind of capital necessary to give them the opportunity to shine on the screen.
Well, they don't want to deal with the minutia that goes in with management, A, and B, they don't want to take the risk.
Exactly. And so that's why this concept that we came up with the cap, where the players are getting more than 50% of the revenues that this business produces without coming up with a dime of contribution, risk, or expenses. That's why it seemed like that was the kind of deal that made sense, at least for the players you thought it would, and if the percentage is right, for the owners it should too.
Carmen Policy went from lawyer to successful NFL team executive, and he has 5 Super Bowl rings to prove it. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website, You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.